Yes, indeed, everybody. We are back with another installment of Jay Flemma Sports Report here on the Golf News Net and iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, it's good to be back. We've got a terrific show for you. A big thank you to our last guest, Robert Trent Jones Jr. That was a really terrific show. And you can look up all of our shows either on iHeartRadio.com or thegolfnewsnet.com. So this week, we are going to go to one of our favorite authors on the planet, a man who is a former editor-in-chief of both Golf Magazine and Sports Illustrated and has made a long and storied career now out of writing terrific nonfiction books. Please welcome back the author of at least a dozen terrific books, Kevin Cook. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jay. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. We've talked about so many of your terrific sports books before. I remember the first one that I read was Driven. That was your book about the kids that were attending the various golf academies.
That's right. And interesting ones. Peter Uihlein went on to be a star on the European tour. I was convinced that Yvonne Lendl's daughter, Isabel, was going to be the next Annika. She's now selling real estate, but was a terrific player in her own right. And that was a really interesting project.
It was terrific to read that one. And then I moved on to your wonderful biopic of the great Titanic Thompson, perhaps this country's greatest proposition gambler and one hell of a golfer himself.
He was ambidextrous. Ben Hogan said he was the best shot maker he ever saw. The reason the great Titanic Thompson never played on the PGA Tour, as he often said, was because he couldn't afford the pay cut. He was playing for $10,000 a hole when Hogan and Byron Nelson were making $10,000 a year. So one interesting thing about Titanic Thompson is that there has been constant interest in making a movie of him. I think he's the most cinematic American character that there has been. And I keep hearing from potential producers, but no movie yet. So I'm open to suggestion.
Well, while we have you here, why don't you tell us a few of those golf stories of Titanic? There's a whole bunch of them, everything from the match that he cooked up between Lee Trevino and Ray Floyd to his hitting wedges into rowboats out in lakes. And when they popped out hitting the hardwood, he went and filled it the next night with sand so that it wouldn't do that.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, Titanic was the original proposition gambler, a legendary figure. Maybe the most famous story, golf story of Titanic's, is that he was in Chicago gambling with the great Nick the Greek and gambling with an amateur fellow named Al Capone, who liked to play cards. Titanic once said in the middle of the winter, you know what, I've got a bet for you. I can drive a golf ball 500 yards. Of course, nobody in those days, you're using hickory clubs. You're using Bellotta golf balls, and it wasn't far from the gutta percha age. So that's not possible. So Titanic took the bets. There was just one provision. He was going to say when it had to happen. So he waited. He waited throughout the whole hot summer in Chicago. Finally, it's winter and the edges of Lake Michigan are frozen, one of the coldest winters in history. And Titanic's playing cards with Capone and company and says, oh, I feel it. I got the feeling now. He leads a whole caravan out of cars out to Jackson Park in south of the Loop in Chicago and teed up a ball, faced the golf course. And then he turned around and faced the other way, faced frozen Lake Michigan, and laced a ball out that is probably still running across the ice, and won his bet. That anyone who has seen Tin Cup, much of Tin Cup was based on the exploits of Titanic, including that one that's transposed to a road. But it's the same principle. The Titanic was practically unbeatable, but he would beat you in such a clever way that you had a story to tell about it for the rest of your life.
Yes, you definitely had to parse his words carefully, no matter what the bet was.
Well, that's for sure. He would tell you, I can throw this heavy watermelon over a 10-story building. And then once he gets the bets down, he takes the heavy watermelon, cradles it in his arms, goes into the 11-story building next door, takes the elevator to the roof, and pitches the watermelon onto the roof of the 10-story building. So you're right that you had to pay very close attention to the terms of the bet.
And you also had to pay very close attention to his sleight of hand, one of the reasons why he was so good at card tricks and golf and pool, was that he had remarkable hand-eye coordination, being able to throw an entire deck of cards through a door jam, for example, from across a room. But as you mentioned, he could play golf ambidextrously. But my favorite is the time that he went with Capone and said, I'm going to throw a lemon on top of a skyscraper. He went over to the lemon stand, okay, where he had an accomplice waiting with a lemon loaded with BBs, mm-hmm. okay? And Capone smelled a rat and said, bought his own lemon, squeezed all the juice out of it, handed it to Thompson and said, throw this one. Well, in faking the big windup, he somehow pulled the switcheroo, pulled the one with the BBs back out, threw it up on top of the skyscraper. And if I recall your story correctly, didn't Capone say to him, you're a pretty handy guy to have around?
Well, yes. Titanic was smart enough to have a backup plan. And Capone, you're exactly right. Capone smelled a rat, said, I'll pick a different lemon. And Titanic is smart enough to have one pre-filled with buckshot in his pocket, and is quick enough with his sleight of hand to do his whole spinning motion on the way to the throwing it, and has that one in what quite a versatile son of a bitch. And Capone said, "You're a versatile son of a bitch."
Well, I'll trade one with you. It was the great Dan Jenkins that clarified that Ben Hogan didn't actually call Oakland Hills the monster, bring this monster to its knees. He said that bastard to its knees.
Yeah, you need to really appreciate the greats in their time. I think it's good not to censor them.
Yes. Okay. As Jenkins also put it, he goes, if Palmer and Nicholas said half the things we attributed to them, they'd have had their own lounge act in Vegas.
Yes, nobody, you know, Dan Jenkins, you know, in his great work for Sports Illustrated covering golf, is, I think, I'm one of the many acolytes who followed that, who went to, you know, there were days when you would go to the newsstand on a Monday afternoon, hoping that they had put Sports Illustrated out on the newsstand because it's going to come out that day, and you wait for it. And the first thing you turn to is Jenkins' coverage of the golf tour.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I couldn't wait to get it in my mailbox at Deerfield Academy. Okay. You waited for the letters from the girls from the dance from the Saturday night before, and you waited for your Sports Illustrated and your Boston Globe. Okay. Those were the three things that you had to read when you were in the pantry, canteen, whatever you wanted to call the snack bar was back then.
Well, I was reading the Indianapolis Star, and its sports coverage wasn't as good as the Globe. So you're pretty much down to Sports Illustrated.
Well, tell us a little bit about your latest book, which is a bit of a departure from the sports world, but boy, one heck of a story that it was. It really was a hellfire. You wrote about Waco.
That's right. Waco Rising is the name of the book, and there's no sports to, there's some shooting and even target shooting. I guess that might qualify as a sport, but that's because the fellow who's often called a cult leader, I don't like the word cult, his name was David Koresh. He led the Branch Davidians in a 51-day standoff against the FBI, against the full might of the U.S. government in 1993 in Waco, Texas. Before that happened, they used to do some target shooting to prepare for such a thing in case it might happen. It did happen and became one of those stories that the whole nation followed for almost 2 months in 93. CNN was still pretty new. You could follow the news for the first time, really round the clock, and a lot of Americans did. I think it's an utterly misunderstood story, one that millions of Americans remember as a fiery moment on television. The full story of what happened in Waco, Texas in 1993 is what I set out to tell.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back. This is Jay Flama, and you're listening to Jay Flama Sports Report on Golf News Net and iHeartRadio. We're talking with Kevin Cook, one of the truly great sports writers of our generation, and now writing several different nonfiction stories, everything from the murder of Kitty Genovese to Flip Wilson, the famous comedian. But right now we're talking about his latest book called Waco Rising, David Koresh, the FBI, and the Birth of America's Modern Militias. So take us through both the story that you're telling and what you think it means for this generation and the future.
Well, in 93, the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, got a search warrant to check out the Branch Davidian compound. These are fundamentalist Christians, people who were an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventists. They believed fully in the Bible. They believed that the last days, the apocalypse was coming in our lifetime. They stockpiled arsenals because the leader, their preacher that they believed was a prophet, told them that there was a final battle coming that would lead them to the apocalypse. They also made a lot of money selling guns at gun shows throughout Texas. So David Koresh, who was able to weave the stories of the Bible, which often conflict and can be confusing, into just such a compelling narrative to his followers. More than 100 people who lived in a compound they built 10 miles outside of Waco, Texas. He had them preparing for a battle against what they called Babylon. That's the forces of the government, the godless forces of the government outside. And in this case, the government cooperated and made his predictions seem to come true. Instead of just serving a search warrant by knocking on the door, the ATF rolls up with two cattle cars full of heavily armed agents in riot gear. They pile out. Soon you're in the middle of the biggest the biggest gunfight in FBI in law enforcement history, as the ATF and Branch Davidians shoot it out. Four ATF agents die that day. This is February 28th of 93, and six Branch Davidians die that day. What comes next is a siege in which the FBI takes over from the ATF, which had botched serving the search warrant. Now the ATF is in charge, circling the compound with razor wire, with Abrams tanks, the same kind of tanks we're sending to Ukraine today, and hundreds of agents waiting for the Davidians to surrender, which they will not do because they believe that this is just what David Koresh preached, that the government is coming to disarm you, to take your guns. What this leads to is a final battle 51 days after the siege began, in which government tanks roll in toward American men, women, and children and spray tear gas point blank at them. They take shelter. A fire leads to the deaths of more than 70 Branch Davidians, including Koresh, and this becomes an international story. It's a terrible black mark on the government and leads to the latter part of the book Waco Rising, which is the connection between what happened at Waco and today's militias, people who believe that what happened at Waco proves that the government really is in league against its people, is going to either take their weapons or come in and kill them if they don't submit. I don't think that's what happened, but what really happened in Waco feeds what we still see, what we saw very vividly on January 6th when anti-government forces stormed the U.S. Capitol, and it's going to continue. I think the best way to fight the polarization between today's militant anti-government people and people who believe that what happened in Waco was a mistake was to tell what really happened.
Excellent. We're talking with Kevin Cook, author of almost a dozen different stories. And right now we're talking about his latest, Waco Rising. So tell us a little bit about the research that you did. How long did it take to write the book? How many trips to Texas? What were the most poignant moments, at least for you, not just as a writer, but as someone studying the story?
It was a two-year process. A lot of the research happened during COVID. So my first plane flight during the pandemic was to Dallas, and then I get in a rented Prius, which isn't a very popular vehicle in Texas. I was pleased that I was not getting shotgunned on the way. But the great thing about Texas is the speed limit is 75, so I'm doing 85 like everyone else, and the guy blowing past in his pickup truck to your left is going about, he's pushing 100. You can get to Waco in not much time. It's 100 miles away. So that was about a half hour, the way that things went there. I met survivors of the siege whom I came to admire. I think they were sincerely religious, and that was very poignant. One of them, named Sheila Martin, left the compound after the siege began to be with two of her children who had gone out before, leaving her husband behind, along with two of their older children. Her husband and the two older children died in the fire. And Sheila Martin, who still believes that Koresh had the right idea about the Bible and the future, still plays his tapes and still counts herself as blessed because she was able to go out and join three of her children outside. I talked to other survivors and could not have been more impressed by the sincerity and strength of their religious faith. I think they were misled by a monster. David Koresh abused young women as young as 12, whom he took as his quote unquote wives. He led his followers into this deadly battle against the forces of the US government that led to their deaths. But I think it's important to separate Koresh from his followers, many of whom are admirable, very sincere people. It's also worth knowing that if you go down there today, the very sight of this huge conflagration that was on worldwide television, a fellow named Alex Jones, whom we've all heard about, believed in a conspiracy of the government to kill the Davidians and led a fundraising drive to build a new chapel that still stands on the site today. And I was there. It's a fascinating place to visit. And there is a new preacher who fancies himself as the successor to David Koresh, as the prophet of the Davidians, who is a QAnon preacher who everything that you've read about QAnon, he believes and preaches today.
You know, as I also am a student of history, having studied it from ancient times up through modern day, I've noticed it even in the literature of the Middle Ages and the literature of the Renaissance and the literature even of just a few decades ago, everybody seems to think that they are living in the last days. Okay, when you it seems,
what a coincidence. Yes.
So, you know, what do you make of that? Why and how?
I think we want our lives to have meaning. I think you're absolutely right that it's a tremendous coincidence that every single generation thinks that it's the last generation in human history. But it's such a persuasive story, especially as told by a storyteller as skilled as Koresh, who can make not only all the strange stories in the Bible add up to a clear, important story that's leading to something that's going to happen in our own times, but it gives his followers a particular role. You have an important, you know, life is confusing. Life is scary. And if you are led to believe that you have a particular role in the coming end of days, an important religious role, then what could feel more important and make more sense of one's life than that? I think that's the secret to many cults. I don't like the word cult. I think sect is fair, or an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventists. When people call the Branch Davidians a cult, as Tom Wolfe's definition of a cult as a religion with no political power made an impression on me, so did the questions that continue about what happened in Waco. Who started the fire? I came to believe that the Davidians themselves, not the FBI, started the fire because they believed it might protect them from the forces of Babylon outside.
We're talking with Kevin Cook, a prominent author, former editor-in-chief of both Golf Magazine and Sports Illustrated. He's got his latest book, Waco Rising, out right now. Tell folks how they can get it, Kevin.
It's on Amazon, and it's also in the independent bookstores, which we should all support. Independent bookstores seem to have been doing pretty well as the pandemic recedes. But as much as I like Amazon, as much as I use Amazon, it's so important to visit your local bookstore and ask, you know, if you ask for my book, ask for any book, just support that store and the book-loving people who work there.
And Kevin, online, where can folks read your writings?
Again, at Amazon. I'm actually a person with little social media presence. But if you put my name in, that's Kevin Cook with no E at the end of Cook, you'll see the books come up on Amazon. There is a new story about this book at The Spectator. The Spectator is the oldest magazine in the world. And there is a lead story on its cover this month, the February issue. There are also stories, reviews about the book. Some of them I like better than others. But there was a very nice one. There was a very nice one from Kirkus. You always look for that star. Kirkus reviews are often harsh. When you get a star from Kirkus, you figure that you've earned it.
We're talking with Kevin Cook here on Jake Lemus Sports Report on iHeartRadio and the Golf Newsnet Radio Network. Let's close the discussion, Kevin, with a little talk about another one of your golf books. Tell us all about Tommy's Honor, the story of old and young Tom Morris.
Well, Tommy's Honor is a book that my first book that it was 20 years in the making, dated all the way back to my 30th birthday, which is now quite a while ago. When I first played with three locals, Peter, and John, who said, "You swing the club like Tommy Morris." And I thought they meant old Tom Morris, like a lot of Americans I knew about him. But in those days, young Tommy, was practically unknown, especially to Americans. And to spend 2 years in Scotland researching that story, which became a movie that I understand any number of Golf Channel subscribers have now seen four or five times. I greatly appreciate the fact that the film made by Jason Connery, Sir Sean's son, who felt it in his bones, has led to a lot more understanding of what the dawn of professional golf in Scotland was like. It's nothing like the game is played today. This is a family drama, a religious tragedy, but a love story also, and Tommy's Honor will always be very close to my heart.
Well, I always love that historic moment in golf at Musselburgh when some of the fellows rolled up on old Tom Morris with young Tom in tow and said, "What'd you bring the wee one for?" And he said, "You'll see soon enough."
Oh, that's a pretty good day. You sound like Peter Mullen there.
Ach, I do a good Scottish brogue. I hang out with John Duggan in the media tent. He gets all mad at you if you make fun of that guy that won the Open in 2005, Michael Campbell. Don't you dare make fun of Michael Campbell. He's a holy man in my country.
Well said. And there was a couple of my favorite moments were not only the fact that the spectators took part to the point of kicking the opponent's ball into a bunker sometimes, but that old Tom Morris hosted a little known until I ran across an account of it tournament among the caddies at St. Andrews one summer. And the first prize was a plump Christmas goose that would be hard to find. Second prize, a bottle of whiskey. And the two caddy finalists wound up fighting to see who could finish second. So they were knocking their balls off the green as hard as they could in order to lose the final and finish second.
Yeah, they wanted the whiskey. Great to talk to you, Kevin. We look forward to having you on again after the Masters to talk a little bit more, not only about Waco and how it's doing, but also some of your other books we didn't get a chance to try, like your book about Philip Wilson or your book about the Challenger disaster or Kitty Genovese or any number of the great books you all can read on Amazon.com. Order them today.
It's always good to be with you, Jay. And I think you're one of golf's best voices.
Thank you. I take that as a great honor. Coming from a fellow like you, that means I must be doing something right. Much love, everybody. We will see you next time on Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio and the Golf News Net Radio Network.